Early in their evening talks around one of Betsy Bell's homemade candles, he decided that he was not fashioned to be a scholar, because the first time Martin handed him a law book that explained the topic under discussion, he found that his interest quickly flagged. And whenever Betsy Bell spoke reverently of some romantic tale she had picked up from her study of history, he would dismiss it as imagination. He was a tough-minded little realist, soon to be 15, and he would leave the life of letters to others better qualified. But he never dismissed the essence of what the Ascots were saying. He knew from looking into their excited faces that there was a lower order of life and a higher, and he was instinctively drawn to the latter. In every court case that Martin discussed, he found himself siding with right and justice, and what Martin sometimes called the only sensible thing to do. These growing convictions served him in good stead when he worked with Yancey Quimper at the inn, for there he saw a completely different type of person. To begin with, Yancey himself was about as far removed from the Ascots as one could be. For example, when the Ascot cabin needed caulking, Betsy Bell tied up her skirts, went into the Brazos, and dug the clay for it. At the inn, when there was work to be done, Yancey always looked about for someone else to do it. He could, in a single day, find a dozen things for Otto to attend. The motivations of the inn customers were also quite different from those of the Ascots. Everyone seemed to be conniving for some advantage, or trying to acquire land or belongings owned by someone else. Arguments were settled not with carefully marshaled words, but with fists or a flashing bowie knife. Otto was by no means afraid of a fight. He knew from experience that he could control adversaries much bigger than he. But he saw that to engage endlessly in brawling was not productive. Yet he enjoyed the liveliness of the inn, and despite Quimper's obvious defects in character, he liked being with him, for something was always happening. Like the time two toughs from Kentucky stopped on the far side of the Brazos and clamored loudly to be ferried across. "Go fetch them," Yancey said. And Otto had gone down the steep bank to where the ferry waited, its two guide ropes attached by rings to the wire that stretched to a big tree on the opposite side. With deft hands he grabbed the forward rope, allowed the current to carry him downstream till the rope was taut, and then pulled sturdily so that the ferry moved forward along the fixed wire. "What kind of contraption is this?" one of the frontiersmen bellowed as they climbed noisily aboard. And at midstream on the return trip, the man who had spoken grabbed the rope from Otto's hands, while his partner grabbed the stern rope, and pulling in the opposite direction, nearly upset the craft. "Stop that," Otto shouted, recovering the rope. But he could do nothing to move the ferry, because now both men heaved on the back rope. He was stronger than they, and knew better what he was doing, so they did not succeed in taking the ferry away from him in their boisterous game, but they did make orderly progress impossible. Dropping his rope, Otto whipped from his belt the pistol that Zave Campbell had taught him to use so effectively. Pointing it at the two roisterers, he said quietly, "Drop that rope." When they refused, he calmly put a shot between the pair and said, "Drop it, or I'm coming after you." The threat was so preposterous, this boy challenging two grown men, that they began to laugh. And if Otto's pistol had had the capacity of a second bullet, he would have blazed away at them. Instead, he leaped forward, knocked one sideways so that he fell into the river, and flattened the other. The pistol shot had aroused men in the inn, and they came streaming down to the bank. A good swimmer, seeing that the first Kentuckian might drown, plunged in to save him, while others waded out to bring the ferry to the bank. When the two travelers were at the bar drinking the watered stuff that Quimper sold as whiskey, one said, "You got yourself a son who's a tiger." And Yancey said, "He ain't my son." And they said, "You better adopt him." Next morning, Yancey tried to do just that. "Otto, I'm making you an offer. You run the ferry, help around the place. I'll give you room and keep, and soon as there's any money, you'll get a share. Meantime, you got yourself a leg up in life." "I'll think about that," Otto said. And he might have accepted, for he knew he needed a home somewhere, and that continued residence with the Ascots was both impractical and unfair. He might have become a river-crossing roustabout had not Martin Ascot been called to the new town of Houston on an important court case. Taking Betsy Bell with him and inviting Otto to ride along, Martin set out for what was now the capital city of the Republic. The three-day ride southeast, across the low, rolling hills between the Brazos and the Trinity, was a reminder of what the new nation might become if it ever stabilized and found enough money to operate. For the fields were rich, the trees grew in attractive clusters, and flowers bloomed everywhere. It was a rougher land, Otto thought, than the terrain he had seen in Ohio, but it was powerful, and he was proud to be a part of it. The first night out, they slept under the stars, but on the second, they found a farmhouse where the wife welcomed them, and the husband was eager to talk politics. "As soon as that drunk Houston serves out his term, what we got to do is elect a real fighter like Mirabeau Lamar to the presidency." "Who's he want to fight?" Martin asked. And the man said, "I've heard him twice. He wants to kick the Indians out of Texas. He wants to fight Santa Annie and whip him proper. And he wants us to take Santa Fe." "That'd be a lot of fighting," Ascot said. And the farmer replied, "Us Texians can do a lot." The town of Houston was a revelation. First houses built in late 1836, a bustling town of 1,200 by the spring of 1837, capital of the nation in May 1837. When the Ascot party rode in, they found movement everywhere, new stores being built at a frantic rate, and eight principal streets, each 8 inches deep in mud. Betsy Bell, trying to alight from her horse, felt her left foot sinking into a quagmire and remounted. There were no hotels yet, but local citizens, inordinately proud of their metropolis, directed the visitors to a remarkable substitute, and when they were comfortably fitted into the private home of Augustus Allen, they heard an extraordinary yarn from Allen himself. "Yup, my brother and I came down from Syracuse, New York, a few dollars in our pockets, dreams in our hearts. We bought, one way or another," and here he shrugged his shoulders to indicate the chicaneries he and his brother had engaged in. Losing his train of thought, he asked Martin, "Do you know how much 100 Mexican leagues of land is?" Before Ascot could reply, he said, "That's nearly 500,000 acres, and that's what we acquired." "You have to shoot anybody?" Betsy Bell asked, and he chuckled. "Well, we set aside the best of our land, here beside Buffalo Bayou, with entrance 40 miles out there to the Gulf, and we decided to make this the capital of Texas. Yep, we give the government all the land they needed free. We give churches all they asked for, schools if you wanted to start one. We give away so much damned land you wouldn't believe it. And why do you suppose we done that?" They learned from Allen's wife that her husband had been a child prodigy in mathematics and a college professor at 17. The Wizard of Upper New York, they called him. And he made no apologies for what he and his brother had done in founding Houston. "We did it to make money. We give away lots to attract attention, then sell what's left at a good profit. There's no hotel for distinguished visitors like you, so I open my house to all who come free." To close the gap between his prodigious learning and the local customer's lack of it, he had adopted Texas speech and sounded sometimes like an illiterate. But on their third night in Houston, the Ascots were invited to attend a session of the Philosophical Society of Texas, held, of course, in the parlor of Allen's house, for he was the treasurer and motivating force. As an afterthought, Allen had said when extending the invitation, "Bring the boy if you wish," and Otto found himself among the founders and philosophers of his nation. Congress was meeting in Houston that week, so many of the legislators participated in the discussion. And Otto quickly realized that these men were much like his father, serious, sometimes robust in their humor, and obviously committed to finding a constructive life. After a satisfying meal cooked by Mrs. Allen, she and Betsy modestly retired, as if incapable of understanding the august subjects about to be discussed, while the men listened attentively to two essays, the Federalist Papers, Key to the American Democracy, and Fielding's Tom Jones, A Threat to Public Morals. Otto could not fathom either the concepts involved in these discussions or the vigor with which they were pursued. But he was proud when Martin Ascott entered the debate with such forceful comment that in the midst of the proceedings, Mirabeau Lamar, president of the society and vice president of the nation, proposed, "Gentlemen, our young lawyer from Xavier County has spoken much sense here tonight. I recommend that he be made our corresponding member from Xavier." The proposal was approved by acclamation, after which Lamar reported, "At the conclusion of our last meeting, several members, including Anson Jones, Thomas Rusk, and James Collinsworth, suggested that the topic then debated with such illumination be continued into this meeting, should time permit. Well, time does permit, and I would like our esteemed secretary, David Burnett, to state the question." Burnett, an older man who had served briefly as president of the fledgling nation during its formative period, rose, coughed, and read the title of the debate which had so exercised the members. "Women, why have we had no female painters or musicians?" And when the pros and cons of this question were discussed, often with great heat, even Otto could understand the proceedings. It was conceded by both sides, anti-women 88%, pro-women 12%, that females were flighty, inconsistent, unable to pursue a goal over any extended period, and apt at any moment to fly off the handle, and that these weaknesses disqualified them for any sustained intellectual or creative work, such as the composition of a Mozart symphony or the paintings of the Sistine Chapel, two examples of art with which most of the members seemed to be familiar. But granted these deficiencies, was the female physique such that it automatically precluded greatness in the arts? The majority decided that it was. Just what these limitations were, Otto could not decipher, for when they orated on this fascinating subject, the members inclined to talk in a code that he could not penetrate. However, several speakers referred with great emotion to the sublime work of art which women are capable of, the birth of those children on whom the future of any society must and does rest. Such statements were always greeted with cheers, but toward the end of the evening, Martin Ascott rose and said, "I have heard much comment about the inability of women to sustain any effort through an extended period. Anyone like me who has lived on the far frontier and seen what a wife can accomplish is astounded by her energy." From his seat in front, ex-President Burnett grumbled, "Ascott, you're so young." And the meeting ended. Its effect on Otto was magical. Even he could see that these earnest men, stuck away on a frontier so different from either Baltimore or Cincinnati, were striving to maintain their interest in the entire world, and especially in those wellsprings of human behavior from which goodness came. He liked these men and their pompous oratory. He was proud of how a younger man like Martin fitted in. And he saw with remarkable clarity that he was intended to be a man like them and not a man like Yancey Quimper. When he returned to Xavier County, he would tell Yancey that he did not want the job at the ferry. But what he did want and where he would make his home, he did not know. If Otto was confused as to where he would find his home, Texas faced an equal quandary. Shortly after the establishment of its government, a plebiscite had been taken, and the citizens produced an irrefutable plurality in favor of joining the United States immediately, and upon any reasonable terms offered. But to their chagrin, the nation to the north rejected the offer. "We ought to march to Washington," customers at Quimper's Ferry bellowed. And Yancey predicted, We'll see the day when Washington comes begging for us, and what will we do then? Spit in her eye, the belligerents cried. But in his kitchen, Martin Ascott provided a more cautious analysis. This dreadful panic makes everyone afraid of making bold moves. I think that what people are really afraid of is another war with Mexico, Betsy Bell said. But her husband struck the deeper chord. It's slavery. Those damned northerners will never let us come in as another slave state. And he was right, because year after year, the northern senators excoriated Texas as a nest of backwardness and slavery, and annexation seemed impossible. Now the contest for the allegiance of Texas became an international affair with three nations involved, and with debate in the Ascott kitchen divided three ways. Betsy Bell, who had learned French from a Louisiana slave who had reared her, hoped that France would assume the control she had tried to exercise back in the 1680s when Texas was theoretically French. And from time to time this seemed possible and even likely. I should love to see this vast area civilized. We have great affinity with the French. Her husband, now a serious student of English law, hoped that Great Britain would take control, and quickly. We would fit in so perfectly with English ways of justice, law, and government. He was, as a Southerner, so convinced that entry into the United States was unlikely that he actively sought union with Britain and propagandized any who would listen, especially Otto. Can't you see? In states like Virginia and Pennsylvania and Carolina, we were English. It would be proper for us to reunite. He assured Otto that Texas rights would be protected and even extended in such a reunion. Quimper's interest centered on Mexico, which was threatening to resume the war. No peace treaty between Mexico and her former colony had ever been promulgated, so that renewal of the war was a real possibility. What we ought to do is let those damned Mexicans make a move against us and then march right down to Mexico City and take over the whole country. They'll never be able to govern it by themselves. Of course, when Mexico did invade Texas and capture San Antonio, which happened twice, Quimper could not believe that his Texians had allowed this to happen and became terrified lest Santa Anna come storming back to burn once again the Quimper Inn and Ferry. Young Otto, listening to these debates, kept quiet as usual, but his ideas on foreign affairs were beginning slowly to solidify, and had he been asked for his opinion, he would have said, "I had enough of foreigners with those Baltimore Germans. I don't want France or England either one, and I hate the Mexicans for what they did at the Alamo and Goliad." What did he advocate? He told no one, but he had firm beliefs. We shouldn't march to Mexico City, like Yancey says, although we could do it easy. We should go clear to Panama, and then maybe take Canada, too. He could see no reason why all of North America should not be Texian, except that the eastern seaboard, which was already American, could stay that way. Then, if the United States should someday wish to join Texas, it would be welcome. The internal affairs of the nation were also maturing, but not always in the direction intended. All observers agreed that Texas could never become a first-class nation unless it developed both a harbor on the Gulf for ocean-going vessels and steamboats for transit up the three principal rivers, Trinity, Brazos, Colorado. Unfortunately, immense sandbars, tenacious and drifting, blockaded all available harbors, especially Galveston's, so that sometimes two ships out of five would not make the wharves, with lives and cargo alike being lost. River traffic was even less successful, because here, too, forbidding sandbars menaced any ship that tried to enter from the Gulf, and those that did succeed immediately encountered snags, sunken logs, and smaller sandbars, and such twists in the course that boats could negotiate the worst corners only with the help of ropes dragged along the shore by sweating passengers who debarked to do the hauling. Occasionally some daring vessel would make it as far upriver as Quimper's Ferry, but two that did were trapped by falling water and spent the summer there. Yet it was an unbroken act of faith all along the rivers that one of these days we'll see scheduled boats landing at that dock. In the meantime, the loss of shipping was disastrous. Ocean sunk at Brazoria. Clematis sunk trying to get to Brazoria. Mustang sunk at Jones Landing. Lady Byron sunk near Richmond. Creole Queen and seven others sunk trying to get into the Brazos. But when this doleful litany was recited at Quimper's Inn, Yancey insisted, with most of the men supporting him, "When a Texian starts to do something, he does it. We'll have steamboats up here yet." The same prediction was made along both the Trinity and the Colorado, where losses paralleled those on the Brazos. Education was also a function of society, about which something was going to be done one of these days. The nation could not afford to spend what little money it could accumulate on free schools, so there were none. But it did allocate liberal portions of the only currency it did have, land, to schools. Sevier County, for example, was awarded 17,712 of its choicest acres, but no way was found to turn this into cash, so no school was founded. However, the county did eventually offer some education. For after the children of Sevier had gone some years without schooling, the Reverend Joel Job Harrison, tall and fiery, and with a wife who could cook, appeared with handbills announcing his intention to open a school. First course, reading, writing, spelling, multiplication tables, $1.50 per month. Second course, arithmetic, grammar, oratory, astronomy, $2 a month. Third course, Latin, Greek, algebra, geography, the copper plate, $3 a month. Mrs. Harrison will accept a few girls and boys in her home, good table, Christian discourse. To inquiring parents, Reverend Harrison gave these assurances. "I am an ordained minister, Methodist faith, but courteous to all. I am proficient in the subjects offered, and I can promise firm discipline, for I will brook no insolence or insubordination, since I believe I can whip all but the very biggest boys in fistfighting." He called his one-room school, a reasonably good one, the University of Sevier. The citizens of Texas sometimes acquired a peculiar insight into how their nation functioned. When General Felix Houston, no relation to the president, was to be replaced as commander-in-chief of the Texian forces by Albert Sidney Johnston, the former refusing to cede office to the latter, warned Johnston that if he wanted the command, he would have to duel Houston for it. And when the duel took place, Houston shot Johnston in the behind and held on to his command. Said the enlisted man who witnessed the duel, "It was a fair fight. If a man wants to lead the Texian army, he better be prepared to fight for the job." But always, the limiting factor was this strangling lack of currency. And when the distressed nation, swamped in debt, tried to salvage itself by printing $2 million worth of redback bills, supported by no collateral except the government's word and faith, citizens evaluated the issue realistically. On the first day it was issued, a dollar bill was worth 50 cents. A few days later, 30 cents, then 10 cents and 4 cents, until it bottomed out at an appalling 2 cents. Shocked by this experience, the government sought another solution. "We'll encourage private firms with good reputations to issue their own currency." "Backed by what?" cynics asked. And the government said, "Their goods, their mills." The experiment was tried, and a relieved Texas watched as this private money system stabilized at about 80 cents on the dollar. One firm, whose notes ranked even higher, announced that it was backing them with every item of our merchandise, our steamer Clarabelle, 18 nigger slaves, and our sawmill. In Sevier County, Yancey Quimper planned to print $5,000 worth of bills redeemable at the ferry, but since he could not specify redeemable in what, the government ordered him to desist. So Sevier continued to suffer. However, Yancey did find a way to profit from the emergency. for he let it be known that he stood ready to exchange what little cash he had for any land certificates in the possession of San Jacinto veterans. And Otto watched as a shattered chain of young men wandered in with certificates that they sold for 2 and 3 cents an acre, and glad they were to receive even those small amounts. When Otto learned what Yancey was doing with these papers, he was amazed. One day, a European gentleman, neither French nor German, but something else, stopped by the inn, behaving as if he had been there before, and he gave Yancey real money for a stack of the certificates. When he was gone, Otto asked, "What's he do with them?" And Yancey said, "Peddles them through Europe. Everybody wants to come to Texas." "Even when we have no money?" And Yancey said, "To people who know, Texas is still heaven." He was right in this assessment, for despite continuous setbacks, the dogged Texians strove to forge a nation based upon distinct characteristics. And none was more basic than the Texians' ability to absorb temporary setbacks. An impartial observer from either London or Boston, evaluating the new nation during this tempestuous decade, would have predicted failure, for nothing seemed to work. But he would have underestimated the capacity of the Texian to take enormous risks, sustained by the conviction that, sooner or later, things will work out. Thus, the Allen brothers could speculate in Houston real estate, hoping that land, which they bought at 20 cents an acre, would soon be worth $200. Reverend Joel Job Harrison could call his cabin school a university in the honest belief that it would someday become one. And Yancey Quimper could spend his last penny on land certificates, trusting that dreamers in Europe would grab them at inflated prices. Everywhere, this faith in the future prevailed. In the midst of Otto's confusion as to his future, the Texas government circulated through the counties a document which would lead to the creation of one of the cherished symbols of Texas life. It called for volunteers to man a unique corps whose nature could best be explained by stating what it was not. First, it was not a police force with uniforms, specified duties, and restricted terrains of operation. Particularly, it would not be subject to supervision by county authorities. Second, it was not a branch of the army with highly organized structure and national obligations. The new force would have no distinguishing uniforms, no government-issued arms, no epaulette distinctions, no medals, no drill. Rarely would it perform in battle formation, and never would it parade. Finally, it was not a secret detective agency working under the command of any district attorney. For even though it would often perform detective functions, its allegiance was to the national government, which insulated it from petty local pressures. What would this potentially powerful new arm of government be called? During one discussion at the ramshackle Capitol, a proponent had finished making the point that the men will not be tied down to any one locality, they will range all over, and someone suggested, let's call them ranging companies. And thus were born the famous ranging units. No set duties, just range the countryside and keep order. The unit to be enrolled from the county centering on Sevier would be commanded by Captain Sam Garner, distinguished veteran of San Jacinto, 24 years old, and as tall and thin as an unclothed scarecrow. His general responsibility would be along the north shore of the Nueces River, and as soon as this was known, the toughest men flocked to his temporary headquarters in Campbell, because to serve along what was called the Nueces Strip was to serve in the wildest, most dangerous, and challenging part of the new nation. The word strip was misleading, for this was not some narrow stretch of land between two settled areas. At its greatest east-to-west reach, it extended some 200 miles. At its widest north-south, 160. It was best visualized as a healthy wedge of pie, the arc of crust running along the Gulf, the point far to the west along the Rio Grande. It was much larger than many European nations, Belgium, the Netherlands, or Switzerland, for example, and also considerably larger than substantial American states like New Hampshire, Vermont, or Maryland. Except for a few meager towns along the north bank of the Rio Grande, it was largely unsettled insofar as permanent ranches were concerned. But it was not unoccupied. For more than a century, Mexican herdsmen living south of the river had run their cattle on the strip, and now cattlemen from the Victoria area in Texas were doing the same. An interesting rule developed. If a Mexican crossed the Rio Grande to work his cattle and picked up a few strays belonging to a Texian, he was a bandit. But any Texian who led a foraging party into Mexico to increase his herd by lifting a few hundred cattle was considered a prudent citizen. When Texas gained its independence, delineation of the border between the two countries was imprecise, with Texas claiming that its southern border lay along the Rio Grande, and Mexico arguing that the border followed the Nueces River far to the north, which under Spanish rule certainly had formed the southern border of their Tejas. A bleak, forbidding, unpopulated no-man's land existed between the two rivers, and from within it undeclared warfare developed. Mexicans prowling in the strip would strike north across the Nueces and desolate ranches in the Victoria area. Texicans would organize furtive excursions across the Rio Grande. The Texas government, ignoring the depredations of its own citizens, deplored the behavior of the outlaw Mexicans. As a senator described the situation during an impassioned debate in Houston, "In organizing furtive thrusts into our territory north of the Nueces, the Mexicans are without shame or honor. A secret crossing of our river, a wild dash to some unprotected Texian hacienda, gunfire, a flaming dog run, a murdered family, and cattle stampeding as they head south become common, after which the invaders scurry to sanctuary in the strip, from where they laugh at us derisively." It was this kind of sortie that Captain Garner's ranging company was expected to halt. Among the first group of volunteers was Otto McNabb, age 15, but more a man than many who stepped forward. Garner, certain the boy was grossly underage, but not knowing by exactly how much, asked, "Son, how old are you?" In January 1838, Otto would be 16, so he lied and said, "I'll be 18 in January." "Come back in January," the lanky man said, and then he instructed the others as to the rules of the new organization. "Provide your own good horse, a change of clothes, a rifle, a pistol, and a bowie knife." "What kind of clothes?" "Whatever you have, no insignia." "Same with the boots?" "Whatever you have. But they should come mostly to the knee, because we'll be hitting mesquite and rattlesnakes." Believing that he had covered everything, he started to go inside the shed that served as an office. Then he stopped. "We think you should wear a big hat. Keeps the sun out of your eyes in summer, your head warm in winter." And studying Otto carefully, he added, "It would make you look taller, too." On the 2nd of January, 1838, Otto bade the Ascots farewell, placed his two rifles across his saddle, and headed south, his big hat bobbing in time with the horse's gait. Before nightfall, he was sworn in, smallest man in his unit, a taut little fighting machine with no uniform and no stated commission, eager to help tame the frontiers of Texas. During the second week in January, word reached the capital that the bandit Benito Garza had invaded Texas and raided a ranch north of the Nueces River, killing two Texians. This was precisely the kind of outrage the ranging companies had been organized to punish. So the informal Sevier County unit was assembled by Captain Sam Garner, 26 years old, 6 feet 2, 158 pounds, flowing mustaches, icicle straight and icicle cool, and a very good man at firing his rifle at full gallop. His first assistant was Otto McNabb, the young fellow of indeterminate age. He claimed he was 18, but looked 12 because of his beardless chin, his almost white baby-fine hair, and his slim, muscular body. "This McNabb," Garner told his superiors, "impresses me as a chilly hombre. When those blue eyes fix on you, beware. The company assembled in the town of Campbell, 52 men on their own horses and with their own guns and knives, who would ride casually south to knock some sense into the Mexicans. When they neared Victoria, their first important stop, Otto surprised his captain by saying, "I want to break away. My mother lives on the Guadalupe, west of town." "We'll all head that way," Garner said, for he was in no hurry. He had learned that fighting could be depended upon to find him out at the appointed time, no matter where he went or what he did. So the other volunteers followed Otto as he headed for the Garza dog runs, and all were astonished when McNabb presented to them the two widows, his stepmother Josefina and his adopted mother Maria, for the women were obviously Mexican. The men appreciated the hospitality the two women extended and were favorably impressed by their well-kept homes. But what won them over completely was the discovery that Maria had been married to Xavier Campbell, the hero of the Alamo, after whom their county and their town had been named. What was he like, they wanted to know? Where was the tree they hanged him from? One man, about 20, just sat munching tortillas and staring at Maria. "Were you really married to Campbell?" "I was," she said, as her plump body moved about the kitchen. McNabb gave his mother a farewell embrace and then kissed Maria affectionately. "That one's a good Mexican," the staring fellow said. But when they were once more on the road south, he asked Captain Garner and McNabb, "Say, I just thought of something. Isn't this troublemaker Benito Garza, the one we're supposed to catch, isn't he from Victoria somewheres?" "He's Maria's brother," Otto said with no embarrassment. "What will you do if we catch him?" "Arrest him." "Is he really as clever as they say?" "He can ride better than you or me. He can shoot better than you or me. And he probably can think better than you or me." "Why is he raising so much hell?" "He's a Mexican," Otto said. "He fought with Santa Anna." "Didn't we capture him at San Jacinto?"
"We did."
"Why didn't we shoot him?"
"We don't shoot prisoners."
At first hearing, this might seem a naive thing for a member of a ranging company to say, because these troops had already acquired a reputation among the Mexicans of Texas as ruthless killers, los Tejanos Sangrientes, the bloody Texians. But upon reflection, it wasn't so absurd, because as Captain Garner himself explained to one newcomer, "We rarely take prisoners," which meant, of course, that after a fight, there were few left to take alive. The lethal efficiency of the ranging company was multiplied by a factor of 5 by a fortunate incident which occurred as the riders were approaching the Nueces River. A supply officer from the Texas Army overtook them to distribute the first official issue of weapons the men would receive. And from the first moment the rangers inspected this small piece of armament, they sensed that it was going to remake Texas and the West. It was a revolver, 34 caliber, with a short octagonal barrel of blue-gray steel and a grip that nestled in the hand. It had a revolving cylinder that enabled the user to fire 5 times without reloading, and was in every respect a masterful piece of workmanship. It was made by Sam Colt in some small town in Connecticut, and a salient feature was that any one part of a given revolver could be used interchangeably in any other gun. And for some curious reason never explained, the first users, all Texians, referred to this superlative revolver as a Colt's. No apostrophe, just a Colt's, as in the sentence, "I whipped out my Colt's and drilled him between the eyes." Understandably, the Colt's became the preferred weapon of the ranging companies, and armed with these revolvers, Captain Garner and his men crossed the Nueces, confident that they now had a real chance of cleansing the strip of Mexicans. But when they rode to the crest of a rise so slight it would have gone unnoticed elsewhere, Otto's mind was attracted to other matters. For as he reined in his horse,
He stared in wonder at the vast expanse of emptiness that stretched before him. An empire off by itself, brown, sere, populated by rattlesnakes and coyotes. It was his first glimpse of the Strip, and it awed him. "It's like no other part of Texas," he said to himself. "And look at that sky." Then he shook his head. "I'll bet the traveler who gets lost in there stays lost till the buzzards find him." As he studied the tremendous land, he observed various interesting aspects. Flat as that new billiard table Yancey Quimper put in at the ferry. Brushland with scrub oak, no tall trees. "But I'd hate to ride through that thicket without protection for my legs, cut to shreds." In these decades, the land seemed almost without vegetation, for the ubiquitous mesquite had not yet taken over. But when Otto looked closer, he saw the real miracle of the semi-desert as it prepared for spring. "Are those flowers?" They were. A multitude of the most gorgeous tiny beauties, gold, red, blue, yellow, purple, forming a dense matted carpet covering a million acres. It was an incredible display of nature's profligate use of color, so luxuriant and beautiful that although Otto had seen the flowers of Texas before, some of the most varied in the world, he felt he had never beheld anything like the minute blossoms of this exploding garden. Captain Garner, seeing that his young assistant lagged, rode back and said, "Immense, eh?" And Otto replied, "One of those flowers would be beautiful, but a million million of them?" Garner said, "They stretch 200 miles. And Otto said, "I thought I knew Texas." "Let's get moving," Garner said. And as they overtook the others, he observed, "Some say we should let Garza and his local Mexicans have this wilderness. Folks tell me they have a reasonable claim, but I say no. With Texas, you can never predict what value land is going to have. You bring water in here, you got yourself a gold mine." "And how do you bring water?" "That's for somebody else to solve. Our problem is that bastard Garza." Wherever the company came upon Texian cattlemen searching for cattle in the Strip, Garner's men heard constant complaint. "This damned Benito Garza has been raiding and running off our cattle." And as the men rode farther south, they began to come upon the ruins of isolated settlements that had been razed, leaving not a shack or a longhorn. The missing owners had been either kidnapped into Mexico or shot. And after the company had seen more such scarred remains, its members became decidedly vengeful. "God help the Mexican I meet," one of the men said. One afternoon, the company apprehended 8 Mexican vaqueros struggling to herd a large number of unbranded cattle toward the Rio Grande. And without asking questions, the Texians initiated a gun battle in which they killed 5 of the Mexicans. Captain Garner, by merely looking at the bodies, declared them to have been rustlers stealing Texian cattle. But when the interrogation of the 3 survivors made it clear that the cattle had legally belonged to the Mexicans, who had traditionally used this range, he had to concede that his enthusiastic riders might have shot the wrong men. "What shall we do with the others?" Otto asked. And Garner weighed this problem for some minutes. "If we keep them prisoner, a lot of questions will be asked. If we let them go, they'll get other Mexicans excited in Matamoros." "Hang 'em," a rider from Austin County suggested. And it was agreed that this was the most prudent solution. So without further discussion of the legality or propriety of such action, the 3 trespassers were hanged. Their leader, before he was strung up, protested vehemently, "But we were on Mexican soil." "It ain't Mexican no longer," the rope man growled as he kicked at the horse on which the doomed man sat, hands tied behind him. With a startled leap, the horse sped off, leaving the Mexican suspended. Otto did not protest this arbitrary denial of justice, for although he was as firmly as ever dedicated to the preservation of law, he, like the rest of his company, refused to concede that the law was also intended to protect Mexicans. In succeeding days, the ranging company similarly disciplined 16 other Mexicans, but uncovered no trace of Benito Garza, who was known to be leading this attempt to control what he and others honestly believed to be Mexican territory. One fiery-minded Mexican shouted, "Garza will teach you, you bastards!" That hanging did not take place, because an infuriated Texian shot the man, even though his hands and legs were tied. At the end of the tour, Captain Garner spoke encouragingly to his youngest trooper. "Otto, how many did you get in the battles?" And the boy replied, with some pride, for he had not blazed away indiscriminately like some, 4. Otto McNabb had found his occupation.